tape recording made with Mr. Ronald Reagan by Becky Boyd at the Los Angeles International Airport on Sunday, the 18th of July, 1965.
Is it all right if it's played in class?
If what?
If it's played in class.
Sure.
And then Mr. Glenn might want to take up. What's your opinion of the students actively protesting the U.S. foreign policy?
Well, it depends on what you mean by protesting. One of the great things of America, of course, is we defend the right of people even to be wrong. So we should always have the right in this country for anyone to differ with the government, differ with policy, express himself. Where I think, though, we're treading on dangerous ground with present demonstrations, particularly regarding the Vietnam policy, is once the normal processes of government, reflecting, as we believe, the majority rule, embark on a course such as actual armed conflict with someone else, then I'm afraid we get back to that idea expressed by someone back in our history who said, my country, right or wrong. Then, while we may, in the legislative halls, debate, or citizens may express their concern to the government over what we're doing, we have no right to aid, to give comfort and aid to the enemy, while other Americans are dying for what our government has said is the interest of our country.
Do you care to say an opinion regarding the professors actively protesting the U.S. foreign policy by teachers?
Well, here again, I think the same thing holds true. A professor can disagree. A professor can disagree with the... he can express his belief in pacifism or disarmament or his belief that we should be friends with someone we're not. But again, when he carries it on to the point of advocating something that is outside legislative debate, when he carries it to the point of something that is urging the breaking of the law, and again that gives comfort and aid to the enemy, such as one professor up at Berkeley who actually advocated that the students should nationwide form a group or take an action, including the burning of draft cards, the refusal to serve in the armed forces, and actually expressed it as leading toward the demand for the resignation of the President of the United States. Now, this is outside the fine structure that was set up for this government to be guided by, of, and for the people. And again, he's losing sight of the fact that once we have embarked on this armed conflict course, there are other Americans who are dying. And we're being killed by what we have now decided is an enemy of this country. And again, they may use anything they want in an effort to persuade the government that it should, if they feel this way, sue for peace, or that they should try to break off and discontinue the fighting. But I don't know how they reconcile their conduct at the moment with the fact that they're undermining the national effort while other Americans are dying for what they believe is the national purpose.
Do you feel street demonstrations are contrary to law and order regardless of a just or unjust cause?
Well, this could get to be very complex, too, in the way you have it worded there. First of all, a street demonstration, if it violates the ordinances that have been laid down for orderly traffic and the moving of people and commerce and business, then this is law-breaking regardless of their cause or their noble purpose. It also brings into focus the idea of whether the people have a right to disobey a law because they disagree with the law. Now, I know one of the leaders of one of the demonstration movements has publicly expressed his belief that there is a higher moral law and that people have a right to disobey laws with which they're in disagreement. Well, if we're going to hold with that, suppose I don't like the income. we have decided he doesn't have the right to take the law into his own hands. I think that demonstrations, if a group believes that they can express a viewpoint to the legislators in an attempt to get an unjust law, or as they see it, an unjust law changed, that they believe that a public demonstration of, say, a parade, a meeting out in public in the streets, should be held, then within, I'm sure, all of our community ordinances, our various laws, there are provisions for them to go to the governing bodies of that community and ask for permission to have a parade. You have to do that to have a 4th of July parade. You can't have the most patriotic demonstration or parade without getting a permit, because there are other people who want to move along those streets. There are provisions that must be made for the rerouting of traffic. Now, when demonstrators continue to such an extent that it becomes a daily occurrence, and city government decides that they can't give this many permits for daily parades, then they are breaking the law when they have such a demonstration.
Do you believe teacher in class should be objective as possible towards politics, or is it all right to let the students know if they lean toward one particular party?
Well, I can hear screams now rising from the academic world when I answer that one, because probably a teacher has to play it a little bit by ear and judge how far he, as an individual, can go in letting his own views be known. And perhaps there is no hard and fast rule for that. But basically, I believe that a teacher is in a relationship with the pupils in which it is his duty to teach them to open their minds and to think for themselves and to make up their minds or adopt a philosophy based on their knowledge of all the facts. And I think it interferes with that if the teacher, in his peculiar position there with regard to the students, lets them know in advance where he stands. It's almost as if he, from a superior position, is saying to the students, well, I'll let you see both sides of the story, but I, who have progressed farther than you, have now made up my mind this way. Having done that, he's planted, whether he wants to or not, a prejudice in their minds against the other viewpoint, because they look to him, they know he's progressed farther in the educational world, and they say, well, from his vantage point, if he's made that decision, the argument must be weighted on one side or the other. I know some teachers, with the best of intentions, think so highly of academic freedom, of their own right to teach as they see fit, that they would disagree with any attempted curb on what they say to students. But I'd like to remind the teachers that we have a strange dichotomy in this country. We have, in our freedom, decided that a free society can't work without education, without illiterate people. I'm not saying illiterate, a literate people. So we have gone so far as not only to provide education for our young people, but to make it mandatory. The parent must send his children to school. Therefore, the parent has certain rights to academic freedom. As the teacher can say, I demand the right to teach the way I want to teach, the parent can say, I've got a right to demand how my children are taught. And down through the years, we have managed to work this out pretty well by our various PTA relationships, the parents and the teachers, and the control of education at the local level. This is one of the reasons why I object to such things as federal aid to education, with the possibility inherent there of federal control. We remove too far from the parent the right to come in and express a view on how their children are being taught. But I'd say basically, the teacher is obligated to present both sides. Here in California, we have a problem, let's say, in the study of economics. Maybe it's more general in California. I would venture to say in the higher echelons of education, probably 99% of the economics that is being taught is the Keynesian theory of economics. But I don't object to teaching the Keynesian theory. I object to teaching only that as being the correct theory, and not letting the student theories and allow them, seeing the pros and cons of each one, to make up in their own minds which one they want to follow.
The July 12th U.S. News and World Report states that you're progressing very well in your bid for the governorship of California. Do you want to say anything about that?
Well, no, I have anything more to say right at the moment, other than that I never sought office. I never wanted this or never had any intention of going into this. We have a problem here in California of a quite widely split up Republican Party, and it dates back many years, not just to the last election or two. And some people have convinced me that there's a possibility as a candidate I could serve to somewhat heal this breach, unify our party. And it was a responsibility I didn't think I could turn down. The only reason I haven't made a definite commitment yet is I want to be absolutely sure that this is true. Now, I don't mean that I want a loyalty oath from everybody in advance, that everybody in the Republican Party is going to support me. I only want to know that I won't be a factional candidate, that if I should be a candidate in the primary, that those Republicans who at the moment prefer someone else, if I should be the winner, that they would still find me acceptable as a candidate, that they wouldn't feel they had to go home or join the other party or something rather than support me. Now, the evidence indicates that I perhaps do have that kind of acceptability, in which case I will jump into a primary and run on the basis of what I believe, if enough people agree with me. Well, that'll be that.
Well, I'm sure my family and myself hope that you get it.
Well, thank you very much.
How do you think the new Medicare program will affect those of my generation?
Well, it's going to, I'm afraid, affect you much more than you realize at the moment, or than many people realize. I am unalterably opposed to the Medicare bill that has been suggested in Washington. Now, let me hastily put in something else, because there seems to be a tendency today, when you make a statement such as I've made, to immediately charge that you're opposed to the humanitarian goal. In other words, you're someone who wants sick people to die in the streets with no medical care. Well, let me put that to rest by saying I don't believe that anyone in this country should be denied medical care because of a lack of funds. But I believe the problem is more widespread than just people who are over 65. And I don't believe that this phony Medicare bill, and it is phony, because trusting elder citizens today believe that this bill is going to take care of their medical needs. They don't realize that it's a bill that is only going to pay a part of their hospital rent for a limited time, and that all their drug and doctor bills are going to still fall on their shoulders, and there's no provision made to care for them. I think we would have done far better had we explored the idea, first, of recognizing that a young man with a large family and a limited income, he's got some medical problems. And they're as urgent for him as he can't wait till he's 65. I think that we should have explored the idea of first establishing need. Who actually has need and cannot make their own provision for medical care? And then, from public funds, we should have set up a program in which all of us, because we do believe in taking care of those in need, all of us contribute through our general taxation, so that medical insurance policies in the present private insurance companies could be provided for those people who have real need. In this way, there would be no embarrassment after the initial determination that a person has a need based on income, their economic situation. A person would have an insurance policy geared to his needs. When he needed a doctor or a hospital, he could go there on this insurance policy. There would be no one to know that he didn't provide that policy for himself, the public funds provided. We have today 146 million people in this country who are covered by medical or health insurance. Many of them by way of their union. Strangely enough, I am, by way of the Screen Actors Guild. I think that, almost fortunately, I could pay my own doctor bills. But we have a health policy in the motion picture industry that paid for our last child when it was born. Take these other people in this same way. Take advantage of this great revolution that's taken place in medical insurance. But the present policy, Medicare, in says that to avoid any embarrassment to the person who has real need, everyone must be in it, whether they need it or not. Now, as I pointed out, I'm covered by a union policy. Why should I now be forced into a program in which I have neither need nor desire? But where it's going to affect you young people is the tremendous cost of this, and the Social Security program has already caught up with us. Adding this to Social Security, which is in deep financial trouble, you'll find that the young man or woman today going to work at an average salary is already paying in to Social Security to provide benefits for people who have gone ahead of them. An amount so great that if the young person had the spending of that same amount of money in their own hands, they could already buy a retirement insurance policy that would pay double what Social Security promised. Now, isn't there a moral question involved in government forcing a young person to participate in a compulsory welfare program when the young person with the same amount of money could double the benefits if they had the spending of that money themselves? Here again, the same policy. I believe that it is a welfare program. It should be confined to those who have real need, and those who can make a better provision for themselves should perhaps be allowed to do so. But this is a, let me add one thing else that you have to say, or other. Social Security, I am not opposed to it. It is here to stay. It's a fact of life, and I think it's a good fact of life. I don't think anyone should be destitute by virtue of reaching unemployment through old age and having no provision for the non-earning years. And I believe that it's good for society as a whole to have this guaranteed purchasing power for a segment of our society. So it lessens the ups and downs of economics. It reduces the possibility of a great crash or depression because you've got millions of people who are guaranteed of a purchasing power by reason of this. And I would be the last one in the world to want Social Security eliminated. But I'm concerned because it's on such a shaky foundation. We have found in election years that it's easier to promise benefits to people, probably with the hope of buying votes, and to put off making provision for how the benefits are going to be paid for.
Yeah, I feel like again, I saw just like buying drugs, it came out right time.
Well, the anti-poverty bill, I think, has a pronounced smell of pork about it. Right here in town, they've taken over a 13-story hotel and with a program to salvage young girls from poverty-stricken families. They're bringing these girls here from all over the country. No one objects to salvaging these young ladies and giving them a year's training and hoping that they will be able to do better for themselves. But the program here in Los Angeles prorates out at a cost of $7,000 a year for each young lady they're trying to help. Well, if you gave her family the $7,000 to begin with, then they wouldn't be poor.
This is Mr. Glenn's question. Being a busy movie and television star, how do you find time to get interested in politics and what makes you take an active part?
Well, I don't know. I guess it was kind of like Topsy. It just grew. I suppose it came about by reason of my activities with the Screen Actors Guild, which, as I've explained, is the union of actors. different, particularly when some of our people were in a 90% tax bracket and they'd be paying 180% of their income if they had to pay in both countries. So out of this, it was an interest that grew of necessity. It more or less brought home that ours is a government of the people, by and for. And if you let this vacuum exist, if the people just go their way and say, well, somebody else will take care of it, will run government, this is what happens. There can be no vacuum in such a human relationship. If we don't run the government, we the people, the government runs us. And this is how tyranny comes about. It's the one thing the founding fathers could never do for us. They never could figure out a way that this system of ours would work without the active participation and interest of the people. And so, as I say, it was more or less forced on me by these guild activities. And as time went on, I learned that other people in other industries had similar problems, matching problems. And so my interest grew, and I sort of traveled the mashed potato circuit. You see, I don't sing or dance, so if you don't sing or dance, people ask you to make a personal appearance. You wind up making an after-dinner speech. And I have always prepared my own speeches and done my own research. And the things that I learned preparing for those speeches about the extent to which we have lost individual freedom as the permanent side of government grew, the bureaucratic side, those permanent employees that are reaching a point where they care very little about which way an election goes because they're taking more and more of the control of the running of the government. This is where freedom was lost. We have, I imagine, 10 times as many regulations just arbitrarily adopted by a bureau or agency, not laws, but that actually have invaded our freedom more than the law of the land. We're still protected by the Constitution with regard to law, that you're innocent until proven guilty. But not, this isn't the case in the regulations. Today, in the farm program, for example, if a farmer violates the regulations that the Department of Agriculture has just put into effect, he has no day in court. He's fined, guilty as charged. There's no way that he can plead innocent. They say you're guilty, and he pays the fine, and if he doesn't pay the fine, they can seize his farm and sell it at auction to enforce the payment of the fine. And this has been done in hundreds of cases. Well, yes, except that I've been making speeches like that for a number of years. In fact, I spoke on the same subject in the 1960 campaign on behalf of the Republican ticket, and again in 62 here in the California campaign. And I've been speaking between election years to chambers of commerce and service clubs and manufacturers groups, labor groups, PTAs, everything all over the country. On this general subject of the growth of government and the cost to us in individual freedom. The difference was that in this last campaign, they put the speech on nationwide television, and it kind of got a little more attention than it had just speaking to various groups around the country.
Yeah, that's very fine speech. Do you have a comment on the handling?
Yes, I'm happy to see that the administration is taking a firm policy. I wish they had started it without waiting until the election was over. I do have a concern. First of all, I think we have to be realistic and face this fact. Communism has never retreated one step from its announced intention to take over the world. They can talk peace and coexistence all they want, but if you look at their own interpretation of coexistence, and they put it in writing for us, they say coexistence is our belief that we should not have a war while we continue peacefully taking over the world for socialism. Because Karl Marx said, and Lenin has interpreted his sayings to mean, that you cannot have effective socialism unless you have it worldwide, a one-world socialist state. Therefore, they have to continue. Now, I don't care whether it's in Dominica or Cuba or South America, the center of Africa, the I seriously doubt. But therefore, Vietnam is just another battlefront. And if we retreat from there, we're only announcing the fact that we'll have to meet it someplace else. Now, I'd like to ask those people who are opposed to the Vietnam policy, where do they think we should make our stand? On a battle line extending from San Diego to Seattle, or Miami to New York, or down the Mississippi River? Where would they fight communism? Where is the point at which they say, we will recognize that these are aggressors and they're aiming at us, and we'll make a stand? And I think we have made a stand. It is in Vietnam. Where I'm critical is I believe that the attempt on the part of the administration to mollify those who are opposed to the policy, to lean over backward hoping for negotiations, is leading us to trade million-dollar bombers and priceless human beings for bamboo bridges and so-called barracks. I would feel a lot better if some of those bombs were dropping on the places where the ammunition the enemy is shooting at us is manufactured. I think that we should, with in the last 6 months, some 210 ships, many of them from our allies, openly sailing into Hanoi and unloading materiel that is killing Americans. I would like to see the 7th Fleet blockade the port of Hanoi. Now, we've just learned that there are at least two divisions of North Vietnamese in South Vietnam. This, once and for all, puts to rest the lie that this is a civil war, that the Viet Cong are South Vietnamese, and that we're interfering internally in the affairs of South Vietnam. Now, with North Vietnamese troops officially in the South opposed to American troops, the way to end this and eventually save American lives is for us to declare that North Vietnam is not a sanctuary, and we should invade north of the border. If North Vietnam can fight a war in which the worst thing that can happen to them is they just have to retreat to their own country, this is a pretty easy war for them to fight. If you want to win a war, the enemy must stand to lose something, and we should convince them that what they can well lose is North Vietnam. That, in other words, we're going to strike the headquarters, and I think it should open before the actual invasion. I think that it should open with bombing of major installations in North Vietnam, rail centers, manufacturing centers, the docks at Hanoi, knock them out so that they can't get this material. And then the Viet Cong, for lack of ammunition supplies, could well dry up down where the fighting begins.
Then the handling
of
the same.
Well, here again, I don't think there was any doubt. We had American citizens in there minding their own business, and they were endangered. And the proof is pretty irrefutable that this was, again, a Castro type of thing, that this was what was communist directed and led. And I don't think we had any choice except to take the action we did. And I hope we stand firm on that. No doubt that Dominica has some internal problems to be straightened out, but I don't think the communists are going to settle them. But we went in to protect American lives. And this, let me add just one thing here, this being the last question. I think that this is, all right. Well, I'll add one thing, though. This is, I believe, the most sacred duty of government, is the protection of the individual. Loyalty is a two-way street, and this is the only excuse government has for even existing. That we collectively say, in return for our banding together collectively, that we guarantee the collective might of all of us, for any one of us, when his sacred and inherent rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are endangered wherever he may be in the world. Now, I don't mean by this that an American can take off to Paris and say, I can break all the French laws and do what I want to, and my country will protect me. Not at all. But when he is legitimately someplace in the world, doing nothing of a law-breaking nature, minding his own business and going his own peace, right to believe that the American flag shelters him wherever he may be. And if we ever adopt the policy of the greatest good for the greatest number, meaning, well, it's all right to kill a few people, as long as the rest of us are able to sit here at home going our happy, peaceful way, then we have forsaken the sacred responsibility of government.
Right. Then, what about the infiltration of communists into government?
Well, of course, communists have always followed a policy of infiltration and subversion. I think this is probably the biggest reason why we're justified in opposing their philosophy. We have a constitution that guarantees the right of anyone in this country to advocate any philosophy so long as he does not advocate the armed overthrow of our government. And we may disagree with these people, but they can stand up and hire a hall and make speeches about it all they want. But the communist has always taken a position that he will pretend, number one, to be not a communist. Now, granted, they have an official communist party and an open group who go out. But here in the motion picture industry, back in 46 and 47, when they attempted to take over this industry, they didn't do it on the basis of saying, we are communists and we want to use the motion picture industry for propaganda. They chose a labor dispute between two labor unions over whether 350 men in the picture business should belong to one union or the other. And they used this gimmick to create a jurisdictional strike, and immediately the thousands of pickets that massed outside the studios and tried to close the industry didn't come from the picture business, were furnished by Harry Bridges. They were longshoremen. And we now know, and it's a documented fact, that the communist plot was to close down the industry. And then when all of us were discouraged with the failure of our own guilds and unions, and there are some 40-odd unions in the picture business, their failure to get us back to work, at the right moment, the communists, without ever saying it was communists, were going to suggest one gigantic union that would include everybody in the picture business in this one union. And, of course, it would be communist dominated and run. And then with that control of the business, they would use our industry for propaganda purposes, to put propaganda over on the American people and sell their point. Well, this is far different than a political party, such as even the Socialist Party, openly standing up and advocating what they believe and seeking to persuade people openly to adopt their philosophy.
And then, how could students budget themselves?
Well, you need some help, and unfortunately, I think too often in too many areas of our educational system, you're not getting help. By that, I mean the disappearance from our history of stories such as the story of Patrick Henry and his speech about liberty or death, stories of our heroes. But I think mainly the student has to review and once again find out the greatness of this system and take a pride in our accomplishments. I know that it's very fashionable today to find all the faults with America, point to everybody else and look what they're doing, and it all sounds great. But then you take a look and you say, here are 6% of the world's population occupying 7% of the world's land surface. This is quite a minority. And we have created 50% of the world's wealth. Now, it wasn't handed to us. It isn't because we've got more imaginative people or that we've got more resources. There are other areas of the world with great natural resources. Russia itself, for example. There are other people who are imaginative and creative and energetic. As a matter of fact, there's no such thing other than the native Indian as an American. We all come from national origins that stem from all those other peoples in the world. What is the one denominator then that we had, the others didn't, that was probably responsible for this great growth of this country, the like of which the world has never seen? It had to be individual freedom. We unleashed the individual genius of every man. We said that every person, and this is the first time really did unleash this genius. And we saw this great growth that was America. Our rags to riches story is so commonplace here in America that we should take a great pride, and we should look very hard at anyone who suggests making a fundamental change in this system. Those people today who say, well, yes, it was all right back then, but now the world has become so complex that we must have a planned and controlled economy. I'd like them to ask themselves, take the greatest presidents we believe that we've ever had, the greatest statesmen that we've ever had in this country, and ask them if they honestly believe, great as they were, that those men could make all the decisions and all the rules and regulate our lives and tell us how to work and where to work and what we should do, and that they could possibly